This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Biden administration is raising caps on the number of refugees coming into the U.S. after historically low numbers in recent years. That announcement comes in the midst of two other big stories related to different kinds of immigration. This week, thousands of migrants originally from Haiti gathered in a makeshift camp at the U.S.-Mexico border. And since August, tens of thousands of Afghans have come to the U.S. fleeing the Taliban. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions on those issues. That's 800-642-1234. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, let's start with that story of increasing the cap on refugee admissions to 125,000 people per year. That would be starting, I believe, next year. Can you talk about the significance of that, Elise?
Yes, that is a fulfillment of Biden's presidential campaign promise when he had originally listed that target of 125,000 for the next fiscal year. You might remember, and listeners might remember, back in the spring, he had attracted quite a bit of controversy for keeping Trump's very low cap for the current fiscal year, which was set all the way down at 15,000 for refugee admissions. And then there was tremendous blowback. So the administration said they would raise the current fiscal year up to over 62,000. What we've actually seen, though, as we're ending the year, the fiscal year at the end of this month, at the end of September, we've only had about 7,000 or so refugees actually admitted in the past year. So some people are questioning whether it's really possible, whether the infrastructure is really going to be in place to meet that target for next year of 125,000.
Can you put this into historical context for us? I was looking at a chart of our annual cap and then the numbers of refugee admissions in the U.S. It's been all over the place, substantially lower, as you mentioned, in the Trump administration. This 125,000, we had levels like that, I think, in the 90s, in the pre-Reagan era. It was way higher than that. Where does this fall in that historical context?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. The Migration Policy Institute has that data really nicely visualized. And you're right, it has spiked during times like in the Cold War when we were really focused on fighting communism through foreign policy with refugee resettlement. It has come down a lot since the September 11th attacks. It's sort of a broad pattern we can take away. Nonetheless, the average has been between 70 to 80,000 for the cap or the ceiling. And then the actual admissions are usually a little bit below that. What we saw before Trump came into office was, again, hovering between 70 to 80,000 was kind of the norm of what was expected for Congress and the president to agree upon for a cap. So then what we saw with Trump was really taking that down every year incrementally down to below 50,000, below 45,000, 30,000. And then again, for the current fiscal year, he had put it all the way down to 15,000, which was the lowest ever in the history of the U.S. refugee resettlement program.
Let's bring on a caller now. We have Rick with us in Milwaukee. Rick, hi. Oh, Rick,
yeah,
are you
there? Thanks for taking my call. I just feel like I'm kind of in a twilight zone. I don't understand. I watch the news, and there's a lot of stories about the labor shortage. And then I see stories about refugees wanting to get in this country, and it seems like some pretty simple math to me.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Elise, how much of a factor is demand for labor in the United States when we're setting immigration numbers, whether it's for refugees or other forms of immigration?
Yeah, that's absolutely something that the local refugee resettlement agencies take into account. So we tend to distribute refugees in our program across about 150 communities in the country. And one of the factors that's considered, aside from family reunification, is the availability of jobs, the cost of housing, sort of what the needs in those local communities are. So Rick is absolutely correct that if certain communities indicate they have labor shortages, in the local and federal consultation process, that would be a chance for them to convey that, you know, refugees could really be useful here to sort of infusing some economic growth or helping address some of our labor supply and demand needs.
And thanks a lot for that call, Rick. Before we move on to some of the other immigration-related news, can you talk about what legally a refugee is? I might use the term loosely for a lot of different people, but it has a legal definition. What does it mean in this context?
Absolutely. So we have something really complex, particularly when we're talking about Afghans, because a lot of the Afghans that people are thinking about as interpreters or those that supported the U.S. military operation in other ways are SIV recipients or SIV applicants. And so technically, they're special immigrant visa holders or visa applicants. And SIVs are admitted in a process that is distinct from the U.S. refugee admissions process. They are eligible for all the same benefits as refugees. So really, it's a legal distinction. But in terms of thinking about fleeing persecution or the threat of torture and harm, they're very much the same in that way. But then we also have temporary protected status. And what's being considered for Afghans now is paroling them. And this parole power is something that is different from refugee or SIV status, and it's a temporary humanitarian protective status, which would not come with the same benefits and support that refugees and SIV holders have. So we do get a little bit confused with these terms. What they all have in common is that these are people fleeing the threat of some kind of life-endangering situation.
We're talking to Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW Green Bay. She's with us for a look at refugee policy in the U.S. and coming up, we'll look at the arrival of Haitian asylum seekers at the U.S. border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Elise Cohen, UW Green Bay Associate Professor of Political Science, about the latest immigration news. Elise, let's turn to Haitian asylum seekers now at the U.S.-Mexico border. Thousands of them arriving, seeking asylum. First of all, why are we seeing asylum seekers from Haiti showing up now? Why now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So some listeners may recall that back in July, we had the assassination of the Haitian president, and we also had a really bad earthquake, hurricane, flooding. So it's been a series of natural disasters that have really compounded the problem with the political crisis. There are also a lot of gangs currently controlling different areas of Port-au-Prince and other parts of Haiti, which make it very unsafe for people even crossing through or trying to go about their daily lives. We see about 60% of Haitians live on what would be the equivalent of less than $2 per day. So there's really severe malnourishment and poverty. And a lot of people also in Haiti don't have access to power and electricity. So when you have that map of the infrastructure problems sort of layered with the political and the natural disasters, this has created the situation where people do not feel safe to go back to Haiti and have been using this alternative route in South America and Latin America to try and make their way to the U.S. southern border.
And these would not be considered refugees, I think, as we were talking about earlier. So what kind of legal status would those Haitians who we're seeing on TV lately now, what legal status would they have?
Yes, and that is an issue because you're right that some of the governments, like even the Mexican government, which is denying them sort of refuge or safe haven, they're saying, well, but technically many of them are not being politically persecuted by the Haitian government. And they're using that very narrow legal definition of refugee. Others, including a lot of human rights groups, say they're still fleeing for their survival, or they're fleeing because they would be harmed or attacked violently by those gangs if they were sent back and deported back. So many are arguing they are asylum seekers. You know, they are de facto refugees. One thing that may be causing confusion for the sheer number that have gathered at the border was the Biden administration had issued what's called the TPS, the Temporary Protective Status, for those Haitians that were already in the United States prior to July 29. And so there might have been some confusion that, oh, we can get this temporary protective status, which would just be for about 18 months or so, if we can make it to the United States. But that was only prior to July 29th. So of those Haitians now that are seeking asylum or seeking entry will not qualify and are being turned away, and in some cases put on flights directly deporting them back to Haiti.
And that's gotten criticism, the Biden administration response, from across the political spectrum, including from the left on those deportations you just mentioned. Could you talk a little more about the Biden policy in reaction to the Haitian immigrants arriving there?
Yes, you're absolutely right. This is something that not only are Republicans using as there's a gear up for the 2022 midterm elections, but also Democrats that had really hoped for more of a change or a departure from the Trump administration immigration policies, seeing very much a continuation And it's strange because we do have kind of a juxtaposition, right? We have this sort of welcoming approach of the Biden administration towards Afghans, but then a very, very stark contrast with the treatment of these Haitian nationals at the southern border. So many Democrats are saying this is a continuation of violating human rights, refugee and asylum protection principles. A lot of this goes back to Title 42, which is a public health order that the Trump administration had put into place last March of 2020 for the COVID-19 pandemic. And there was a lot of pressure on Biden, including from medical experts, to remove that Title 42, basically saying there's a blanket ban on claiming asylum for single adults because of COVID-19. And those medical experts have said, you know, this doesn't really line up with how COVID-19 can be contained and managed. And so pressure also from Democrats for him to lift the Title 42.
And bringing two issues together, Haitian migrants at the border, Afghan evacuees in the United States, including here in Wisconsin. And some have asked why they're being treated differently. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas talking about that on CNN.
We are bringing in Afghan nationals by air after they have been screened and vetted. That is a safe, orderly, and humane process. That is quite different than irregular migration, illegal entry, in between ports of entry, in a time of pandemic, when we have been quite clear, explicit, for months now, that that is not the way to reach the United States.
Elise, what's your reaction to what we heard from the Homeland Security Secretary there?
Yeah, that's a great clip because I think we can hear the sort of defensiveness because that pushback is really being felt. Some listeners may have even seen the images that emerged this week of Border Patrol agents on horseback using long reins, sort of appear as whips to try and round up and corral or herd these Haitians that are carrying bags of food as they try and return to their encampments along the river there at the border with Mexico. And so this sort of inhumane or degrading treatment has really put pressure, and I think you can hear that in his voice, that he's trying to say, well, Afghans are different, they are allies, and this is an overseas orderly process that we have for vetting them, and just keeping that very much distinct from what a lot of the public thinks of as, you know, the illegal immigration problem of the southern border. But it's interesting to think about the connection between them, as you said, and even thinking about U.S. culpability in supporting some of those dictatorships in the Cold War that are embedded a lot of the corruption and human rights abuses we see in Haiti today.
Elise, just in our last minute or so, with climate change, there's going to be a risk of more hurricanes or droughts or other conditions that are going to affect poverty-stricken countries in the Caribbean and Central America. Do we need to think more about those issues in the future?
Absolutely. That's a great point to end on, Rob. I think climate change is one of the common drivers now that have pushed a lot of people to want to move away from the strict legal definition of quote-unquote refugee that you mentioned before, that it's not just about political persecution from governments, because many people will be fleeing for their survival based on natural disasters and the inability to really just inhabit their countries from these climate effects.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She talked to us today about the latest immigration news. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. How often do you go for a walk? The shoe company Rockport says since the pandemic started, people have been walking a lot more. According to a survey they released in spring of this year, 53% of Americans are walking between 1 and 5 miles more each day. Nearly two-thirds say they do it to stay physically healthy. 6 in 10 say it's a good stress reliever. And 93% say they're at least somewhat likely to continue walking outside for health and stress relief once COVID-19 has gone in the rearview mirror. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to go for walks? How come? What do you get out of it? Where do you go? Just the neighborhood, or do you seek out some natural setting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got two guests with us from Marquette University. Sandra Hunter is a professor in the exercise science program in the Department of Physical Therapy and director of Marquette's Athletic and Human Performance Research Center. Sandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Stephen Saunders is a professor of psychology and the department chair. Steve, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And Steve, let's start with you. Why is walking good for our mental well-being?
Well, walking is such a wonderful form of exercise. It's not particularly strenuous. Almost anyone can do it. And, you know, walking is beneficial because, first of all, you're probably outdoors. Being outdoors for walking is more beneficial than doing it on a treadmill indoors. And you're out in nature, you're getting fresh air. Hopefully you're doing it during the daytime and you're getting some sunlight. All of these things are known to help people with their mental health. We help, you know, improve their mood. It helps you sleep better because you do get some exercise. It gives you an appetite. And especially if you go with someone you like, or perhaps even better, someone that you love, it's really hard not to have a nice, enjoyable conversation with someone while you're walking side by side with them.
That's the mental side of things. Sandra, walking is probably the exercise I do the most, but I got to admit, when I'm doing it, I think, does this really count? Is walking really exercise?
Oh yeah, it counts. It's really good to hear that you do it. It's, you know, it can be a low to moderate form of exercise, and there's so many benefits. We know that exercise is medicine, and it is a form of exercise. And like, you know, Steve said, everyone can do it. It improves heart and lung function. It increases muscle endurance. There's so many benefits. It helps sleep patterns, like Steve said. It helps your immune system. It actually slows the aging process. It can really stabilize and promote weight loss. And, you know, it enhances brain health. And there's so many, it actually increases life expectancy. They've done studies where they've compared people who've walked, say, 8,000 steps versus 4,000 steps and seen that it increases life expectancy by up to 51%. And it really protects, like many forms of exercise, against diseases such as cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and stroke, just to name a few. So the benefits of this sort of low grade, or can be really moderate depending on what sort of path you choose, whether you're choosing hills, can be so beneficial. There's just so many benefits to walking.
And Sandra, I know a big part of exercise is making sure you do it regularly. How do we build a habit like walking, or I guess any form of exercise? How do we build that into our daily routine?
Yeah, you've got to treat it almost like, you know, brushing your teeth, that it's, understanding first the benefits of it, but just sometimes getting the motivation to get out there. So one of the things that I've adopted is not to bite off too much. You know, often we'll have these sort of, you know, these New Year's resolutions. I'm going to walk for 150 minutes because that's what the CDC and says that I've got to do, you know, per week. And that, which would be like 30 minutes a day. But if you could just take off, just start small snack bites of exercise, which is what I call it, even 10 minutes will start you in the habit. And then what happens is people say, hey, I actually really enjoy this, and it becomes a habit. But I would say the first thing is to start small, so that you are successful, that you actually keep engaging in the activity. Because it's better to have small bites many times than none at all, or one big one and then you're done. So,
and Steve, I have found that if I'm anxious about something, like say a huge global pandemic, for example, going out for a walk, I might catch myself kind of gritting my teeth early on and, you know, kind of all tense. But after a while, I feel it winding down. Can you talk about walking for relieving things like anxiety, big or small?
Well, any type of exercise, including walking, and maybe especially walking, because again, it's relatively easy to do. You don't get all sweaty. You don't have to shower necessarily afterwards, especially if you do it with someone else. Any type of exercise is extremely healthy for our emotional health. It's actually perhaps the most powerful mental health intervention for people with anxiety or depression, which is the two most common mental health issues that people confront. And of course, anxiety, you know, if you're not anxious about this global pandemic, there's probably a little bit something wrong with you almost. Everyone is anxious about it. We should be anxious about it. It makes us take care of ourselves and be cautious about things. But yes, walking, it just after a while, and it's not intentional. That is, it's not like I'm During this walk, I'm going to reduce my anxiety, my stress level. It just happens naturally, and it's the blood flow. It's the blood flow to the brain. It's, again, if you're engaging in conversation, it's looking around and realizing how beautiful the world is, especially in spring and fall in Wisconsin and over the summer. All of that has such huge emotional benefits. And one thing I'd add to what Sandra said about getting into the habit is, again, find that partner that you can walk with and make a commitment to each other. Hey, don't let me back out of this. Let's walk every morning at 8:30 or between 7 and 7:30. Let's walk together. And then if you've got someone kind of helping you meet that commitment with you, being part of that commitment with you, it's so much easier to get in that habit and enjoy yourself more.
Talking about the health benefits of walking with Stephen Saunders, professor of psychology, Sandra Hunter, professor in exercise science, both at Marquette University. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, I just want to support what Sandra said. I'm a musician, and the best advice I ever got about practicing was, don't think about practicing an hour a day. Think about practicing 10 minutes, and then you'll probably end up practicing an hour a day.
I love that, Tom, because I'm a musician, too, and I'm right there with you. So I used to think, if I'm not going to play for at least 20, 30 minutes, it's not worth picking it up. And now I'm like, no, pick up the saxophone. You'll get in 10 minutes. Maybe you'll keep playing the 20 or 30. I think that's great advice. Sandra, that can help us. If we're willing to start small, we might keep that momentum going, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's just something that I've adopted in many areas of my life, not just exercise, but, you know, work. It's like, oh, I don't want to get this done. But and then I'll just say, okay, 10 minutes. I can do 10 minutes. I can do anything for 10 minutes. And then when it's done, the stress relief is so much, is so great. But it applies to exercise and walking as well. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for that call. Great advice, Tom. I appreciate it. Now, Steve, you mentioned walking outside is ideal. In some conditions, whether it's weather or neighborhood, traffic, whatever, or personal well-being, it's not always accessible to walk outside. Do you see those mental health benefits, even if, like I do sometimes with my step counter, I pace back and forth around the house like an idiot? Do I get something out of that too?
Pacing like an idiot is always beneficial, I find. I hope so anyway, because I do it a lot myself. Any type of exercise is really useful. Being outdoors, especially being in the sunlight, and you know, we're heading into fall and winter where sunlight becomes a more valuable commodity, more rare, if you would, commodity. And sunlight is so beneficial to us with regard to our emotional well-being. But being indoors, getting some exercise, it's nearly as impactful. You don't get the beauty, you don't get the scenery. You're probably less likely to be chatting with the friend. So, but indoors, outdoors, exercise, again, as Sandra pointed out, this is legitimate exercise. You know, people set themselves up to get into an exercise program, and it sounds so overwhelming, and it seems so overwhelming. Start with a walk around the block. Start with a walk to the end of your block and back, and then pretty soon you'll fall in love with it, and you'll get used to it, and you'll make it part of your regular routine. But certainly any exercise, indoor or outdoor, is very beneficial. And especially, you know, winter is coming and we're all going to be knee deep in snow at some point. And it is a little bit harder to walk outside then. But research does show that sunlight is so important. And if you can get out there in the sun and get both benefits at once, that is particularly healthy.
Sandra, one thing I've noticed is that if I'm up and walking around, it means I'm not sitting around doing nothing. Can you talk about the problems of a lifestyle that's too sedentary, too much sitting around?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And didn't we find that with the pandemic? It's just so true that we're all sitting in front of a computer for a lot longer than we typically were. And we were losing some of that incidental activity that's so precious, and we don't even realize that we're doing. But they've found that sedentary behavior, almost independent of, you know, planned exercise, is a predictive factor of life expectancy and disease and a whole host of things. So just that incidental exercise that we get by moving around and walking and, say, taking the stairs versus the elevator, or walking to and from the car, which is something that I missed when the pandemic really hit first on. That it is a risk factor for some of these diseases and life expectancy, and independent of planned exercise. So just trying to incorporate this, you know, walking in everyday life, regardless of whether you plan it or not, is really important.
We'll leave it there. Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Steve, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Been talking to Sandra Hunter, professor in the exercise science program in the Department of Physical Therapy at Marquette University, director there of the Athletic and Human Performance Research Center, and Stephen Saunders, professor of psychology and department chair at Marquette. We talked to them about the physical and mental health benefits of walking. I want to give the last word, though, to Jamie, who wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jamie says, I walk alone, without sound, and early in the morning. I love seeing nature that's not present during the day, as well as the humans I see out exercising or walking their pets. I do it for the exercise, but also for the fresh air and the time to think my own thoughts that refresh my spirit. Almost poetical there, Jamie. Thank you so much for that.